Welcome back to Insights Now. I'm David Kelly, Chief Global Strategist here at JP Morgan Asset Management. Despite uncertainty at the outset, 2024 is shaping up to be yet another impressive year for the economy and markets. A resilient consumer has put the US on pace for another year of above-trend economic growth, and the S&P 500 has rallied over 25% so far, breaching 6,000 for the first time in history. That being said, with a new year comes new challenges and opportunities. As the cyclical imbalances triggered by the pandemic and tight monetary policy continue to fade, economic conditions should normalize further in 2025. However, a new element of policy uncertainty has been introduced by the Republican sweep of the White House and Congress. While new policies might hurt prospects in some asset classes, they could benefit others, and investors have plenty to be excited about heading into the new year. To dive deeper into our 2025 outlook, I'm excited to be joined by Gabriela Santos, Chief Strategist for the Americas here at JP Morgan Asset Management. If you're listening to the audio version of this podcast, you can now watch along on YouTube by tuning into our JP Morgan Asset Management channel, linked to the show notes. Now let's get started. Gabby, welcome to Insights Now.
Great. Thank you so much, David. Happy to be here.
To get started, what sort of themes do you think are going to be most relevant for investors next year?
So we titled our Year Ahead Outlook, Out of the Cyclical Storm and Into the Policy Fog. So out of the cyclical storm is this idea that largely the economy and profits were normalizing after all of the pandemic-related shocks. And then you were starting to see the economy settle in at its more normal growth rate. Inflation was normalizing. The Fed was getting started with normalizing rates. And you had these other powerful, more long-term tailwinds behind the economy, like investment in AI, infrastructure, electrification, and diversifying supply chains. But then we had to add that second bit to acknowledge that after the election results are known, but we still have uncertainty about the actual economic policy, what's exactly going to happen in terms of scope, sequencing for things like trade policy, as well as fiscal policy, immigration, regulation. So some of those things can still change the outlook for the economy as well as for different asset classes. And then the last big theme is generally, it's still an environment that supports risk assets, things like equities and corporate credit. But we have got to think about the starting point in terms of valuations, concentration of portfolios. And the main action item here is just to rebalance things going into a more normalized economic environment.
Yeah. Before we get to that, though, let's go back to the consumer, because the consumer really was the hero of 2024. I mean, that is really what allowed the economy to keep growing. How resilient do you think the consumer is going to be in 2025?
Isn't it interesting? It was such a big topic for the election. And when you look at consumer confidence, still very, very low. Big focus on the cost of living, on inequality. Yet the consumer showed up.
Right? Well, maybe just grumpy about the length of the checkout lines.
That's right. Grumpy, but yet willing and able to spend. As we saw with the latest figures, consumption growth close to 3%. Mm-hmm. Very respectable. And of course, we've had waves of support behind consumption. First, excess savings, which took a while to come down. Then credit, especially last year. And now really was about a pretty good labor market. 18 months of positive real wage growth. So still at the aggregate level, a pretty decent consumer. Of course, very different if you look beneath the surface. If you listen to companies, for example, they are talking about a more choiceful consumer, especially below middle class. So it's not perfect, but on aggregate, still pretty good. That said, for next year, it does feel like as long as the job market's okay, which we think it will be, consumption can stay positive but moderate a bit from these levels that are still a little bit elevated. But David, I want to turn to you, given, of course, all of your contributions to our economic forecast. What stands out to you? And importantly, how might the outlook change given this policy fog that we have next year?
Well, I think that some of the policy fog will you know, clear and we'll see what it's going to do. And some of it will remain during the year. So I think overall, we go into 2025 really with a continuation of what we've had in 2024. So far, it looks like the economic growth we had in the middle of the year and probably in the fourth quarter is going to be enough to generate decent job growth. We're going to get a bit of a bump in inflation, over the next few months just because of year-over-year comparisons. But overall, you know, this economy is not fundamentally inflationary if you don't do strange things to it. But the question is, will we do strange things to it? Mm. And so as the next year, as 2025 unfolds, I think the first big question I'm going to look at is how strong and how quickly is any tariff policy implemented? Mm. Because if you have significant tariffs and then retaliatory tariffs, that could cause a lot of uncertainty, that could slow down business spending. It certainly could add something to inflation. And because, you know, if we get, you know, higher tariffs on goods imports, that does tend to squeeze lower middle-income households, because upper-income households spend more on services and they're not going to get hit by tariffs. But you could get that squeeze in lower middle-income households. So that will all sort of play into the story. And so you get that. But on the other hand, you'll have some deregulation, which in various industries, which will, I think, unleash some animal spirits and make business leaders feel more positive. And then you'll have also the prospect of some very big tax cuts coming in 2026. I mean, a lot of it's just the extension, of course, of the Tax Cut and Jobs Act. But there were a lot of other campaign promises which Donald Trump made on the campaign trail. And now that the Republicans will have swept Congress and the White House, he may well be able to implement a lot of these. And so the question is, you know, just how much is added on to this big tax bill as it makes its way through Congress? I do think that what's going to happen here is you're talking about an omnibus reconciliation bill. This is a way you can get it through the Senate. You get one bite of this apple every year is the omnibus reconciliation bill for the next year's budget. So it'll head through Congress over the course of the summer and eventually get enacted. And the question is just how much stimulus is on that. You know, do you have a cut in taxes on tips, on overtime, on Social Security? Do you have a special tax break for interest on new vehicles? Do you have a cut in the corporate income tax rate from 21% to 15%? A lot of that will stimulate economic growth. It could also add to inflation in 2026, certainly will add to deficits in the long run. But I think we'll be sort of caught between some of the drag from tariff uncertainty this year or in 2025, but then also helped out by the prospect of a lot of stimulus, a lot of growth in 2026.
And I think by the time we're ready to write our mid-year outlook, we should have a lot more information here to shape the contours of the overall direction of the economy.
This will surely have some impact on the Federal Reserve. And futures markets are showing that people are not quite as sure that the Federal Reserve is going to be cutting throughout next year. So what do you think about that? And what do you think about that for fixed income investing?
So I think that going into next year, the Fed was really on a course of normalizing interest rates, which basically meant going back to the old normal before the financial crisis, where you had positive real rates and they were trying to figure out exactly the end point, but something 3-3.5%, and getting there gradually since the economy was doing well enough. It's interesting to think about how that might change now. As we heard from Chair Powell at the November meeting, they're not here to front run any of this economic policy. They'll take it as a given once they have a bit more clarity around the dollars here that we're talking about and the actual sequencing of the policy. But the market has certainly readjusted its expectations for interest rates. Mm-hmm. At the moment, investors only see an additional 100 basis points from here until the end of 2025. So interest rate cuts from 4.6% to 3.6%. We previously had expected interest rate volatility to really decrease, given the Fed seemed to be in a pretty predictable path. But unfortunately, I think it's another year of elevated interest rate volatility as we try to figure out exactly how gradual the Federal Reserve might want to be with additional rate cuts and exactly where that endpoint is. Lastly, that's, you know, on the short end of the curve for the Fed as it tries to figure out these countervailing forces. But there's also the long end of the curve, which is already responding to more elevated deficits and the potential of higher inflation expectations due to tariffs and perhaps even immigration policies. And so the long end stays pretty volatile as well for another year after two pretty volatile years. So I think for fixed income investing, number one, there's still reinvestment risk in cash. there's still the need to increase duration somewhat, but not too much. Mm-hmm. So neutral to even short duration there. Number two, much more of a focus on taking more active bets in terms of credit risk. Mm-hmm. If you think about companies, fundamentals still pretty good, all in yields of 7.5 in high yield, that's not bad. And then number three, think about certain dislocations within fixed income. Something like municipal bonds have really sold off recently, but are still quite attractive from a yield perspective, of course.
Okay, so let's pivot over to the equity market. 2024, like 2023, was kind of a year of the Magnificent Seven still. But do you see that changing and changing in 2025?
So it's interesting to see how it was really a year of two halves here for the equity market. The Magnificent Seven kept extending their strong run, but really until mid-July. And then you did start to see a correction in the Magnificent Seven and a catch-up in the rest of the market. So mid-year, we were seeing Magnificent Seven contribute about 66% to year-to-date return, similar to last year. That's now fallen to below half. Mm-hmm. So that's encouraging, and we expect a continuation of this broadening out. And it really comes to broadening out of earnings growth. That's been such an important theme this year. Magnificent Seven earnings have remained strong, on track to grow another 30% this year, but expectations are higher there. Whereas the rest of the market, this has been a year of normalizing earnings growth. They're finally stabilizing margins while still seeing pretty good revenue growth. So finally, we expect to see about 5% earnings growth ex Mag 7, and that's fuel to the fire here. Lastly, when it comes to actual policy, if we think about some of that aspects to tease out, they are more positive for non-Magnificent Seven. Mm-hmm. Things like less regulation of financials, for example, or just less antitrust enforcement for consolidation across a whole variety of industries. So I think that gives us even more conviction that this broadening out can continue. But of course, the AI theme is still very powerful. It's really leading to a lot of investment, helping the economy, but also helping earnings growth within the U.S. It's just that the winners from it are broadening out, right? There's more than just seven companies that can benefit.
Speaking of broadening out, will this equity market rally broaden out further from the United States to the rest of the world? And how does the incoming Trump administration, the possible tariff policy, impact your view of investing outside the United States?
I think in the short term, it is more challenging for the rest of the world. So if we think about the two main mechanisms, the number one is trade policy. Mm-hmm. And if we truly see an administration which starts and really hones in on utilizing tariffs as a tool to enact concessions from China and perhaps even from Europe, for example, then that's something that can lead and continue to lead to weaker currencies. We saw that in the trade war 1.0. You had a appreciation of the dollar between 10-15%, depending on the currency. And you can also see just volatility underlying equity markets. But there are two things that provide a bit of a comfort there. The first, starting points. The dollar is already 14% stronger than it was at the start of the trade war 1.0. And number two, you do have also equity markets that are at a 40% discount to the U.S. coming into this versus a 17% discount the first time around. So double the discount here. So that starting point does matter. It does help to limit somewhat how much currencies weaken and how much these markets correct. And of course, we have to consider China's response. They might have some ability to increase monetary and fiscal stimulus to counteract some of this. I do think for Europe, it is a tougher environment with more limitations in terms of fiscal policy. So for us in international equities, it's really a focus not on the cyclical dynamics, Europe-China, more of a focus on structural long-term stories. Mm-hmm. For example, Japan. Huge tailwind around corporate governance reforms and multiple expansion. Or India, really a country that's benefiting from positive demographics reforms and insulated from these trade wars and even a beneficiary from them.
And sort of broadening out the lens even more, how do you think the environment's going to change for alternative assets?
Yeah, so I think it's interesting within alternatives. It's kind of like embracing normal, both new and old. In terms of new normals, I think across the investor base, there's much more of an ability to incorporate alternatives in public portfolios. So that is going to become the new normal. I think also it's thinking about the old and historical ways that alternatives can help portfolios. They can help increase return, they can help increase yields, and they can help increase diversification. And especially now that we are talking about more volatility in interest rates, more uncertainty still around inflation, that really, really places an emphasis on the diversification mm-hmm. point. And for return and yield, it's that high starting point for valuations for public markets. Now, if we think a little bit more about where we're going into next year for alternatives, there are certain areas that have already repriced quite a lot to this environment of higher interest rates and lower activity. Think real estate. So private real estate prices have really come down to account for this environment of a higher base rate and also some weak activity in areas like commercial real estate. So that might be a market that's a bit of a turning point here. Mm-hmm. But I do think the environment around rates and mortgage rates might limit how strong the real estate market can come back next year. In terms of policy, if we think about less regulation, that's something that can spur more M&A, maybe even IPOs. So an important turnaround also for things like private equity that haven't been able to do these deals and give liquidity back to their investors. Now, there's one area that really hasn't seen any kind of cyclical correction, and that's private credit. And it's grown so much, same size as the investment grade and high yields market. Mm-hmm. And at some point, there might be a credit cycle. Rates aren't coming back down to zero. And so, yes, it has great yields, but it's also important to think about that maybe that cyclical storm might still come. And then lastly, infrastructure, transportation haven't seen a repricing, but that's normal. And there are all of these positive tailwinds around reorganizing supply chains, AI investment, electrification that provides such an important long-term tailwind.
So lots of interesting alternative strategies to think about adding to a portfolio. So how would you sum it up? I mean, if you're giving advice to an investor who's thinking about, okay, what should I do going into 2025? How would you sort of sum up some of the things they really ought to be thinking about?
I think it's much more about what to do within portfolios. And this is where the starting point is so important, because if we think about the environment that's prevailed for the past 2 years, it's been one where there's been very concentrated performance, equities over fixed income, cash over core fixed income, growth over value, tech over any other sector, U.S. over international, public over private. It's like we've been on this boat of portfolios whipsawed around by the cyclical storm, and now the storm has cleared, yet the boat is still very mm-hmm. lopsided here. So I think the number one thing to think about is how to rebalance portfolios. So think about cash rates coming down and investors needing to rebuild more of an intermediate core fixed income allocation, while, of course, still focusing on duration and credit risk, as we talked about. Or within equities, we find beneath the surface there's still very much a heavy tilt towards growth over value, even in core strategies. So rebalancing in line with this broadening out of earnings and performance in U.S. equities. Or if we think about international versus U.S., mm-hmm. leaning into some of the long-term positive stories there and even maybe using some tariff-related sell-offs in the dollar or these markets as an opportunity. And then lastly, this tilt towards a little bit more private markets and thinking about whether it's for income, taking off a little bit from the bond side, or whether it's for total return, a little bit from the equity side, or diversification a little bit maybe from the core fixed income side. To me, it's still a positive environment for risk, but the number one action item is just checking in on how lopsided portfolios are and using opportunities to rebalance.
So you need a more balanced boat as you sort of enter the fog of uncertainty here.
Yes, yes. Otherwise, if you're already lopsided and
get hit by the wrong wave.
Exactly. And then poof, it's better to have much more of a sturdier ship going into it.
Yep. Well, Gabby, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks so much, David. Appreciate it.
On our next episode, I'll be joined by Jack Manley, a global market strategist on my team, to discuss asset allocation, To all our viewers and listeners, thank you for tuning in today, and speak with you soon.
This content is intended for information only, based on assumptions and current market conditions, and are subject to change. No warranty of accuracy is given. This content does not contain sufficient information to support investment decisions. It is not to be construed as research, legal, regulatory, tax, accounting, or investment advice. Investments involve risks. Investors should seek professional advice or make an independent evaluation before investing. The value of investments and the income from them may fluctuate, including loss of capital. Past performance and yield are not indicative of current or future results. Forecasts and estimates may or may not come to pass. J.P. Morgan Asset Management is the asset management business of J.P. Morgan Chase & Company and its affiliates worldwide.